survival guide.
So, I'm literally just about to show Melissa this picture of me at SaveMart.
We're talking about vintage clothes and, like, buying secondhand stuff. And I was like, oh my god, apparently the gold mine is in SaveMart Upper Hutt. And that we need to, like, venture out.
Because
my friend Kerry, like, is all about buying secondhand stuff this year.
Yes. Sidebar, go Kerry. What a great...
Yeah, she's awesome. She's like, I'm not going to buy new things, like, blah, 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 saving the world. And I was like, fuck, that's so cool. And so she's been to all the stores.
Yes.
And she's like, through and through, SaveMart Upper Hutt, absolute goldmine.
Because there was a SaveMart in Waitangirua, which is really close to here. It's like just off Aotea area.
It's still there.
Oh my god, somebody told me it closed down.
There is one in Porirua.
What, like Porirua or Waitangirua?
Like, I don't know where Waitangirua is, but it's like, it's pretty close to here. It's like maybe 12 minutes away.
I feel like, is that the same store?
Okay, I'm gonna Google it.
Because somebody's told me recently that it had closed down. Okay, maybe it hasn't. But yeah, going full circle. Yes, so Melissa's talking to me about...
Yes, it's in Waitangirua.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, it's still open. Oh, but I went with Kerry and she was like, okay, this is shit compared to the one in Upper Hutt.
Oh, well, the one in Upper Hutt is huge. I'm pretty sure it's like two warehouses.
Whoa.
Yeah, like she's big, she's thick.
But then like Olivia just goes, oh, by the way, did you know my photo is up on the wall
and save at the Upper Hutt SaveMart?
And I was like, excuse me, what?
Yeah, so okay. Was this. It was the shoot. So yeah. There was four. This girl, I don't want to get this wrong, studying at Massey.
Yeah.
Studying like maybe fashion? No, photography. I think she was doing photography. Fashion photography?
Combined on. Yeah.
At Massey, and she wanted to do like a recycled kind of theme.
That's cool.
So we all drove out to SaveMart in Upper Hutt,
mm-hmm.
and did this shoot. It was me, this other girl, and another guy model, and I think the photographer ended up sending photos back to SaveMart being like, hey, here were the shots, and they put them up on the wall.
Oh my god. Yeah, it's very wholesome.
It's so sweet.
But then also now you're making vases at SaveMart. Amazing.
I'm Upper Hutt SaveMart famous.
Shit.
I should just walk into here and
be like, hey, like, what's up?
Own the place.
Yeah.
Do you know who I am?
That. And just point.
See that tiny photo? That is me.
Me.
I wonder if I got tagged. I feel like there were other photos where I'm in a trolley and whatnot, and we're just hooning around. Anyway, I'm going to put my phone away. Goodbye, phone.
Goodbye.
Au revoir. Need some, you know, detoxing from my phone, so I'm going to stare at my laptop.
Because fuck, who needs to look at a small screen
when you can have a medium screen? Hello!
Oh, hey there!
Hi, listeners! That's Melissa Lowe.
And what you're hearing is the beautiful voice of Olivia Poppy.
And that's Ziggy and Missy. You might not hear from them. You might!
I think Zig is pretty vodka. He'll just, like, do a grumpy old, like, harumph.
A woofumph?
Yeah, he's, like, he's very, just, like, spontaneously, it'll just be, like...
So, what kind of doggos are they? I feel like let's give them
we
a
should, yeah, I think they deserve an introduction. So, they're both Bichon cross poodles, mini poodles.
Aww.
And, like, as you can see, Zig is more Bichon.
Definitely.
And Missy is more poodle.
Yes. Because she's got the little tuft of floof on top. Like
she's like she number one like looks more like a poodle. We've groomed her more like that as well. But like her schnooter is so long that she can't rock the Bichon look.
She got the long schnooter.
She's got a very long schnooter. But then she's also like she's got the personality of a poodle as well. Like she's incredibly intelligent and gets very bored, and so she just like self-destructs and
oh.
just like finds food wherever she can.
Oh, I was going to say she was a very classy lady. When you said she's classic poodle temperament. No. But yeah, very classy, very French.
No.
Likes to eat croissants out at the front of the cafe type
thing. I mean, like, she would, but she'd also eat it if it fell on the floor.
Missy in Paris.
Yeah.
Well, with them being chill and you looking pretty chill, why don't you tell me how you survived the week?
This week? Hoof.
Hoof.
Hoof, hoof, hoof.
You have the greatest words.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been good, I think. Trucking along.
Tried any Welly on a Plate burgers?
Yo. Yes.
Where'd you go?
And they have been not great.
Oh.
They're like good.
Yeah.
But like.
Where'd you go? Like, okay,
so the first one, I went to the one at Firebird, and that one was just like a fried chicken.
Where?
Not Firebird, Thunderbird.
Oh. Sorry. Sure.
Thunderbird Cafe. You know the one on Featherston?
Like Featherston?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was okay. It was just, like, very average.
Oh.
And, like, the portion was, like, very small in terms of the chicken. But, like, it had curly fries, and curly fries are always a banger.
Okay, so the hero of the dish were the fries.
Yes.
Bummer.
Yeah. And so then I went to Pickle and Pie.
Yes.
Yeah. And so a colleague had hyped it up a lot. Like, okay. He was, like, oh my god, they drizzle cheese fondue on the burger. It's amazing.
That sounds incredible, yes.
Yes, so I like rallied a huge group from work.
Nice.
There was like 12 of us.
Yeah.
And we all went. And the cheese was like, it was like in this tiny little cup. And like, it was like this much cheese, like very small
like
amount.
Like a centimeter of cheese in that tiny cup. Yeah, and
like, when you went to like pour, like it was so thick and like glumpy that like it wouldn't pour, so we'd have to like use a knife and like scrape it out and like spread it on the burger.
Oh, that's not fun.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, like hyped up the cheese a bit. The burger was good. Like, you were
given misinformation, so nobody can blame you.
Everyone was like, Melissa, you hyped it up so much, and I was like, I only hyped it up because I heard hype. Like, this is secondhand hype that we've suffered from.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, the burger was still yum. It was still good. But okay. I think it just didn't meet the expectations because it was hyped up so much.
Oh, my goodness. That's such a bummer.
Yeah.
I've only done one Wellington on a Plate burger.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like I set the bar real high. So, I feel like I should just leave it there. So myself and five work colleagues went to Bellamy's in Parliament, in the Beehive.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, so you have to book quite far in advance. Mm-hmm. I think, and all lunch times are possibly booked out now.
Yeah.
But we went just after work. And so the burger was just classic. Like, that's all we could think was classic flavors. It was beef, cheese, good. Tomato sauce, mustard, yes. Crunchy,
yeah.
Soft bun. Oh my gosh, it was so yummy. The only sad part for me was that the portion, as you say, was kind of small.
Right.
I would have liked a chunkier burger. But I suppose the kind of the environment that you're in, it's all beautifully, how do you say, like, the interior design's super
right,
beautiful.
Like the aesthetic and design.
Yes, and so
right.
They probably didn't want to go for the big, chunky,
I see.
Sloppy burger.
They probably, yeah, like a bit of, like, class. It's like a nice burger.
Yeah, like, just, I'm sure Jacinda Ardern eats there every now and again. So it's got to, you know, we got to set the standards pretty high.
But, like, great that the burger tastes great.
Because
I
it
think,
was delicious.
Because I went to another one at the tasting room on Friday. And
oh, that's near me.
Yeah. And it was a, don't go there.
Oh.
another chicken, fried chicken burger.
Okay.
But, like, they were trying to do so many different things.
Oh, wow.
And the bread was horrific, and it ruined the whole burger.
Oh.
It was supposed to, I think that... It was,
how can they you said, fuck up bread?
I don't know. Like, it was, like, supposed to be chili corn bread or something. But, like, it was tough and, like, dry.
Ugh.
Like, you kind of had to, like, yank it off, the burger, and then, like, kind of chew for ages. And, like, it just ruined the whole thing.
That is such a bummer.
It also kind of, I mean, it's an insight as to how important the bread is.
I mean, absolutely the like, bread's important. Yeah,
but it was just so disappointing. Like, the chicken was all good. And, like, they were doing, like, this fix and fog mayonnaise. And it was yum. So, like, all the stuff.
Fix and fog mayonnaise?
Yeah, it was, like, fix and fog fire something.
Yes, smoke and fire.
Smoke and fire mayonnaise.
Okay, I'm intrigued, but I'm also scared.
Yeah, cause... but, like, it was good. Like, it was yum. Okay, like, all the flavors were there. It was just, like, this bread that, like, absolutely ruined it.
Bummer.
Yeah, it was a real shame. And they charge so much for it as
well.
That's
the other thing for me. It's so expensive to participate in Wellington on a plate. Like, my flatmate has had about 6 or 7 burgers now. And that easily would have set her back 200.
200, yeah.
Maybe, maybe 300 if she got the beer pairing.
Yeah,
or if you ordered drinks or if you ordered something else while you were there.
Like, it's an expensive thing. Like, I back it because, especially during this time, it's like, you know, you're supporting local establishments. And, like, it's great. Like, it's you know, bringing a spotlight into restaurants. It's, you know, there's a lot of creativity going. A lot of the times nowadays they, like, I mean, not this year because of COVID, but a lot of the times they all ship in chefs from overseas, which is kind of shit.
What?
We yeah. do that. For like Welly on a Plate, they'll like fly in chefs.
That's cheating.
Yeah. Like maybe not Burger on a Plate, but Welly on a Plate, they'll like.
Oh, yes. Okay. So for people who are perhaps not from Wellington and don't know this, there's 2 offshoot brands of the whole concept of Wellington on a Plate. So there is Burger on a Plate, which is where a whole bunch of restaurants and bars and whatever put together a burger, a specialty burger, and they have usually some sort of New Zealand craft beer.
It's normally pairing. Garage Project, isn't it?
Yeah, it isn't usually Garage Project. I don't know why. There are plenty of craft beer.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it has a craft beer matching, but Wellington on a Plate is more like a...
Is it just one dish?
It's...
Sometimes.
I want to say it's more of an event.
Yeah.
You know, like, you could pay... You could buy a ticket to something where they're doing, like, a Sri Lankan evening.
Yeah.
And because they're... I mean, I don't know any other Sri Lankan places around town. So they'll have, like, authentic Sri Lankan produce and chefs. So maybe that is where they are flying people in to put on this one night.
But it's not just that. Like, yeah.
But that's kind of the idea. You buy tickets to an event rather than just going to a restaurant and ordering the burger.
Yeah. And so, like, what people have started to do, because Wellington on a Plate has become such a big event.
Yes.
The restaurants will, fly chefs in to create dishes for Wellington on a Plate. Because, like... You like if you win stuff, like your restaurant just
you have bragging rights.
Like I think, the prizes reflect well in how they do afterwards.
So I yesterday was out running some errands and I was with my flatmate and she was like, okay, we need to grab a snack somewhere. And I had heard about this place, Grace Patisserie, on Tory Street. And it was really sold to me. Apparently this woman, Grace, obviously started this patisserie and she is an incredible, I want to say... desserts, pastry chef.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure she won. She was like completely unknown and she entered something in Wellington on a Plate and it just she won.
Yeah.
Like completely blew everybody out of the water. And I after I didn't even know this place existed. It's up it's almost opposite more Wilson's Harvey Norman place, you know, right-hand side. Yeah, so okay. It's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just this little store, huge kitchen at the back, though, and it's so beautiful, like high-tea kind of vibes. And so we went in there, and oh my gosh, everything just looks so beautiful. But I had been told, try the croissant, because apparently she has this technique, and there's 100 layers in the croissant, and they're all perfectly...
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, well, I fucking love croissants, so off I dragged my flatmate, and we got the almond pan chocolate croissant.
Fuck.
And it was chef's kiss.
Just, shit. Well, now I need to go. All right.
Yeah, it was really, really delicious. Like, as soon as I tried it, I thought to myself, this is what a croissant should taste like. So,
okay.
That is one cool thing I know that has come out of Wellington on a plane.
Amazing. Yeah, you get to discover a lot of cool places.
So anyway, this is a survival story podcast.
Oh shit, yeah, what a tangent.
In this podcast we talk about extreme true survival stories that just blow us away, and so
yeah
in general we hope it also blows you away.
Yes, but wait, first before we Zigger's panting, Salt's team.
Oh no,
bit hot, bit he's, bothered,
he's old, he pants.
Bless you. Before we get into that, I just thought I'd ask you how your week was.
Because... Oh, my week. Oh, it's not important.
No, Liv, it's always important.
Righty, kafighty. So I work at Crown Law, obviously, and I actually stopped one of the Deputy Solicitor Generals
mm-hmm.
on her walk past my desk, and I went, hey, want to go for a coffee? And she was like, yeah, I'm free right now. And I was like, oh my god. It was like 2:30 in the afternoon. I'd kind of intended for my comment to be like, oh, at some point, you know, when you're free. But when the DSG says to you, yes, I have time right now,
you're like,
I was like, I'm suddenly okay. Free. Yeah. I have all of a sudden got a free afternoon. So I thought, shit, okay, let's go. Because she is just so lovely and super approachable. And I feel like at Crown Law, we have these incredible, fantastic female role models who are just killing it and so talented. And yeah, so we ended up just popping down for a coffee.
Oh, love.
And having just the best chat. And I was telling her all about my boy woes. And she just like had great advice. And I could so tell, like, there were moments when she was just chatting to me like girl to girl.
Yeah.
And then moments when she was like, okay, but tell me, you know, you don't have joint bank accounts, you don't need it. As if to be like, girl, let me sort you out.
Yeah.
That was so, like, it was just so cool seeing her be like, this is what you got to do.
It's also so funny, like, that legal lens that you have.
Yes, like, at that's times, such a good word.
It's like, I find it sometimes very infuriating that I just constantly think like that. But sometimes it's helpful in those regards.
Because you're like, I can help people who are like right in front of me with this like problem. Anyway. Anything else? I don't really think so. That's just kind of my general vibe. At some point, I really hope that I can do this podcast and you're going to ask me how my week's been. And I'm going to go, like, Melissa,
amazing.
The best week I've ever had in my entire life. I did this, and I'm so happy. And that day will come, but just not now.
It's not that week this week for you.
It's not that week.
I feel like it was kind of that week for me. Sans, like, the shit burgers that I had. But, like, what a first world problem. We'll try zoom through this. Okay. But I think there are some really cool discussions about this story. Okay, are you ready?
Oh, I kind of need to pee. I'm going to pee.
Okay.
I'll cut this out, I promise.
Introduce you to Norman Olestead. Norman is a lifelong adventurer. It's in his blood. When Norman Olisted was young, he was unstoppable. He skied at 3 years old, whipped down difficult Black Diamond slopes at 4.
Damn!
Surfed mammoth tube waves in elementary school. So no physical fear, or mental fear for that matter, was left unchallenged. His father, also named Norman, was a one-time FBI agent turned lawyer who devoted himself to training his only son in extreme sports. His dad was a notorious adrenaline junkie and started pushing Norman into the scene about 5 minutes after Mama Olisted popped Junior out. So, on February 19th, 1979, when Norman was only 11 years old, he was in a plane that crashed and he was the sole survivor. What was supposed to be a 30-minute plane ride turned into a 9-hour test of survival.
Oh, God.
This is the story of Norman Olisted and his incredible survival story.
Okay, so he's 11.
He's 11.
Okay, so he's a baby.
Yeah. So the sources, it was a bit limited. I read a great New York Times article, which was actually published, like, in 1979.
Oh, wow.
So, like, one of the OGs. There's various media outlets, like CNN, that reported on his story when he released his memoir. And for all the listeners out there who want to learn more about his story in detail, you can read his memoir. It's called Crazy in the Storm. And I'll talk a little bit about that later. Okay. So, yes. As stated before, Norman and his father were big into extreme sports, and at a young age, he was a truly gifted skier. So it was therefore unsurprising that him and his father flew to a ski resort at Big Bear, California, to pick up a trophy that Norman had won in 1979 Southern California Slalom Skiing Championship.
Was that Father Norman or Baby Norman?
Baby Norman.
Okay, Baby Norm.
Baby Norm. As they were riding in their tiny single-engined Cessna, which is, I think, a small plane, about 10 to 15 minutes into the plane ride, they flew into a blizzard through the California San Gabriel Mountains. In the plane was the pilot, Norman, his father, Papa Norman, and his father's girlfriend, Sandra.
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock was there. Sorry.
Okay, Sandra was there. He said all the windows were grey. You couldn't tell up or down, left or right. The grey clouds were just pressing against the windows. It didn't even seem like we were moving. Then there's a limb reaching out of the fog and disappearing. Then another one and another one. Then realizing we were in the trees. And then maybe a few seconds after that, another tree. And then I knew that we were about to crash. I yelled, "Watch out!" And I curled up my body. I felt three thuds. The first one must have knocked me cold. Oh, the third one, sorry, must have knocked me cold. I remember feeling those thuds in my spine. A clear memory of that. Then I woke up who knows how long after. So their tiny Cessna crashed into the mountains, 8,500 feet up. So that's 2,600 meters up the mountain. Norman's father and the pilot died immediately upon impact.
No!
Norman's father, his coach, and his hero was dead.
No!
His father's girlfriend, Sandra Bullock. No, Sandra. Is it Sandra? I don't know. Survived the accident, and so did 11-year-old Norman. Sandra was badly wounded, and young Norman was tossed violently onto the mountain in the freezing February chill, and he had broken his hand during the fall.
Ugh, I mean, okay. That's
pretty...
That's better than him breaking his back or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he... Yeah.
Very lucky, really.
Yeah. So Norman surveyed the crash, and he tried to wake his dad and the pilot, but they were unmoving, dead. He recalls, I yelled for my dad instinctively. Dad, Dad, I can't breathe. No response. You know, it was some part of me that thought, oh, he's knocked out and I'm not strong enough to wake him up. I just couldn't really conceive the fact that he was dead. But yeah, so...
Major PTSD to be able to retell events at 11 years old in this much detail.
I think this was a bit later on, but
Yeah.
So, afraid of freezing to death, Norman and Sandra first huddled under a plane wing in a desperate attempt to get warm. After waiting and waiting for someone to rescue them for 7 hours, they realized they couldn't stay still or they would freeze to death. And so, blinded by heavy snow and faced with a raging wind and below freezing temperatures, Norman had to try and guide the injured Sandra to safety.
Luckily, what, Norman took the helm and was like, hey, grown woman, follow me. Okay, Sandra Bullock.
She was a real liability. So luckily, though, Norman's father planted small seeds in him that helped develop the skills in the water and mountains, unknowingly preparing Norman for this very day. With his father taking him backcountry skiing, skiing with him on steep and icy runs to make him a better ski racer, and taking him to ice hockey practice at 5 a.m. every weekend, forcing him to face his fears out on the surf, Norman's father unconsciously conditioned him to feel comfortable in the storm.
Wow.
So Norman knew that they wouldn't survive the night with the freezing conditions and attempted to make their way down the mountain face. He says, I told Sandra we had to go because the storm was getting worse. It was getting colder and I sensed eventually it's going to get dark and I don't want to be up here in the dark because we're not going to make it through the night. And she didn't want to go, but I insisted that we go. So the snow and ice was actually so deep that it came up to Norman's waist at times. So what they did was grabbed a stick nearby each and used that to steer while they slowly slid down on their bums.
Oh, wow.
Thrusting the stick in the snow when he began to go too fast for comfort.
So the stick, just for listeners, is out in front of them.
Yeah, they're just kind of like sit.
So the stick goes first, kind of.
Yeah, so that'd be like slow. Yeah, that'd be like, whoa, break.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But the face was often icy in areas, very icy. And Sandra was trying to move ahead with Norman, but she had a broken arm and a dislocated shoulder.
No.
Suddenly, upon moving with difficulty, Sandra slipped. Norman attempted to stop her slipping, but went right over him. This slip injured Sandra to the point where she couldn't get up. As Norma described her, though she could open her eyes, she seemed to be so badly hurt that she could no longer talk. Her body was discovered later by a rescue team, only 100 yards from the scene of the crash.
Oh, poor Sandra.
Yeah, Sandra didn't make it.
Oh my god, no! I was making fun of her for her name, thinking she was going to survive.
And like, being like, Norman's? The one leading this adult woman, I was like,
Oh, okay. She did.
Yeah.
Tributes to Sandra.
Yeah. So now I'm by myself, just me. I did have something that came across me that I just pushed away immediately, which was, okay, now I don't have an adult weighing down on me and trying to manage her and myself. So, like, he, like.
Okay. So he was actually.
Kind of relieved.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
He's
in survival mode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was a liability because she was just kind of like, kind of hanging on.
Yeah.
Slowing him down.
Super panicked as well. Yeah. Probably well out of her comfort.
So with Sandra unmoving, Norman had no choice but to leave her there and to keep going. At one point, he heard a helicopter above him. He stood up and frantically waved at them, thinking that they could see him. Unfortunately, this was very wrong, and they quickly left the location, leaving 11-year-old Norman by himself once again. Nevertheless, he pushed on, as his father had taught him through his youth, when the going gets tough, you just keep going. Giving up was never an option. Indeed, he said at the press conference right after the rescue, "I never gave up. Dad taught me to never give up." He said he felt instinct take over and became an animal, similar to the wolf, an animal fully at home in the treacherous wilderness. So, like, you're right with, like, this whole, like, survival instinct just, like, takes over. And he was just, like, so weirdly conditioned to mm-hmm. just, like, deal with this sort of situation. So, alone on an icy mountain, Norman carefully made his way down through the freezing air. The skin on his fingers came off in the cold, but he says he was never panicked, never afraid, and everything his father had taught him sustained him. That's so gross.
Broken hand, no skin. Loving that.
And 11.
I know.
Yeah. So Norman had 2 miles, so 3.2 kilometers from the plane crash to the safety on the ground.
Wow.
He alternated stopping and sliding, using the skills he had been perfecting from his skiing and surfing with his dad, knowing the right angle to turn and how to best glide. He had complete control of his body and could pull off the moves necessary to get through particularly dangerous areas. He almost felt at home. As Norman put it in his memoir, a below-freezing temperatured blizzard with slippery ice was nothing unlike what he had done for the last 8 years of his life. He was much more than prepared. Indeed, he had to scale a vertical gulch of stone, and he thought it was fine. He breezed through it. So Norman took 9 hours to make it down those 3.2 kilometers. And when he reached the ground, he found himself in a meadow, and he still had to find shelter. But luckily, his father's lessons kicked in once again, and Norman knew to look for running water. So he found a flowing creek and walked along the creek until he ran into a ranch house where people could then call for help. So a rescue team only came once the clouds shrouding the mountain had lifted, and when that happened, they found the plane crash and the bodies of Norman's father, the pilot, and Sandra nearby. Norman came out of this whole ordeal with a broken hand and scratches from the crash. When asked how he was doing, he said, "I'm a little bit achy, that's about it."
Wow. Okay.
Kept alive by sheer will, Norman summoned everything his father had taught him about determination and courage to save his own life. Norman is now 53 years old. He wrote a memoir called Crazy in the Storm, and he released that in 2009, which gives a detailed account of the plane crash while also talking about his parents, his parents' failed marriage, and his upbringing with his dad. Norman has a son, and he sees himself following his father's parenting style, but not as extreme. Norman is now thankful for all the teachings that his father gave him and hopes to teach the same lessons to his own son. So when he released the book, the media would ask why he chose to come out with his story when he did, 30 years after the accident. And he said, "I think that unconsciously I didn't write the story sooner because I didn't have both sides of the story, which is I wasn't a father yet. And I thought, this is the time. I definitely have the same instinct that my father had, which is I want to share these passions with my son. I think it's important to expose him to surfing, skiing, hockey, whatever it is. And because I know that along down the line in his life, He will find beauty and pleasure when he needs it, and he'll always be able to go to these things no matter what's going on in his life. I don't force him the same way my father did or coerce him quite the same way. I sort of offer it over and over and over, and every once in a while he'll take me up on it. And so that is the story of Norman Olmsted and his crazy survival story of surviving a plane crash, making his way down an icy mountain in a blizzard, all the while being 11 years of age.
You gotta wonder how he survived and other people in the plane didn't. You gotta wonder, like, how...
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of curled up.
You just got to wonder, like, where, obviously, the pilot's in the front. Maybe it was the dad and then the son, and then maybe Sandra was at the back or something.
Mm. He did, it did say that, like, he kind of toppled out of the plane. So maybe, I don't know.
It must have, the plane must have broken apart then.
Yeah, it did. I think it must have been just, like, a lucky miracle that he just...
kind of got tossed out.
Yeah, and tossed in a way that didn't quite harm him as much, because the pilot and the dad died upon impact.
Yes, maybe they got well crunched. Yeah, and then the plane kind of split.
I wouldn't,
and
yeah, like out. I wouldn't say like crunched beyond, like, because they, I think they obviously looked fine.
Went in, yeah,
he yeah, because he went and like
to wake him up.
Yeah, he thought they were just like sleeping.
Oof.
Yeah, but what I found really interesting was just like that, like unconscious upbringing that kind of prepared him
to handle
all of these things. So like, I think it's interesting. I mean, obviously in this situation it's quite an extreme circumstance where like Norman's father was like an adrenaline junkie, so he would take him surfing and like backcountry skiing and like force him to like go through these things when he was like 5.
Yeah.
And
I think as well, potentially, if that had been his upbringing and, you know, he wasn't older and so he didn't have all this other, I don't want to say mess in his head, but all these other perhaps conflicting views or ideas in his head that grow with experience, it was all he really knew, which was how to manage environments like that.
Yeah,
perhaps obviously not the plane crash, but being in the cold, being in a situation where you need to get yourself out and you need to, you know, like that was kind of all he knew. And it's,
yeah,
it's,
and I think like him and his father had been in situations where it was like kind of survival sort of shit on the rig.
Yeah, like, but again, possibly not to this extent, but okay, we're up on the mountain. We've got perhaps a very icy face that we need to ski down. You know, the kid could bow out, but the dad obviously wasn't going to let him. He's like, how are you going to get us down this mountain?
Yeah.
So he probably gave him that opportunity as well to take the lead and say, you know, you figure it out. How are you going to get us down?
And I believe, like, in the memoir, like, Norman talked a lot about, like, how his, like, he would hate it. He would hate all of these, like, adventures that, like, that put them in super sticky situations. And he'd be like, why?
Scary.
Yeah, he'd be like, why do we have to do this? And then his dad would be like, you know, like, you'll see the beauty in this. You'll see the pleasure in these things when you accomplish it. Like, just do it. And it's really, I just think it's so interesting because, I mean, we, you know, we live in such sheltered, privileged lives that we, like, we'll learn some things, but we don't really learn about survival shit.
Absolutely. You know, I'm hearing all about these new stories as we talk about them on this show, and I think I would have died possibly within 10 minutes of this situation.
Yeah.
I just, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And to think that, like, you could probably teach your kids perhaps not as young as 4 or 5, but like you can teach kids some pretty important things. Like my partner and his dad used to go on like hikes every year, and they'd do like little camping trips, and you know, it was very cute and wholesome, and his dad would like keep him safe, and it wasn't nearly near as like crazy as this. But like he learned some pretty just like basic survival things that like he'd tell me when we go camping, and I'd be like, oh shit, like never would have thought.
Yeah.
Well,
I can make a mean fire from my time as a scout.
Shit.
My time as a Boy Scout.
Oh my god, Liv, you were a Boy Scout.
I was, except I was a girl. No, because I wasn't in the Girl Scouts. I was in the Scouts.
You were in the Scouts, but you just happened to be...
I was one of, I think, 4 girls in,
I love.
In the entire...
I didn't know that they let girls in.
Yes, they...
I like that.
Yeah, I think, actually, I don't know. I think there's been girls allowed in it for a wee while now, but certainly when it first started, it was made just for boys.
Young boys in the wilderness. Yeah, because I thought, like, the girl equivalent was brownies and, like, girl guides.
Yeah, girl guides, yeah. It absolutely is. Well, I got into Scouts because... a friend of mine from my primary school, her parents ran the scout group and the Cubs and the Kias. And I think, you know, my parents were good friends with them, still are good family friends. And I was like, hell yeah, I want to do this. This looks fun. Camping and shit. and I learned how to make fires and tie ropes. And
it's so, like, I'm like, fuck, like, when I have kids, I'm sending them out to do that shit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm going to join in. I don't know if they'll let me, but...
I think they will. Yeah. I definitely remember my dad coming on some...
Amazing. Things. I just feel like these are, like, essential skills.
I have so many strange and hilarious memories from my time as a scout. But do you know the other thing that you talked about in the story that I have noticed that has come up a lot is that headspace, that feeling of being almost like an animal.
Yeah.
Turning into an animal of that environment.
We are an animal. We are animals. We are animals. It makes sense that we would have this... animal instinct when we're put
it's more
in
though
that...
sorry, I was meaning more the fact that he saw himself as a wolf,
right? Like a animal wolf, of that environment.
Yes, like a wolf designed to survive and navigate that environment. Knew where to step, knew what ground was shaky or what, like, almost instinct he picked up, and he himself was like, I'm a wolf.
Yeah.
And I've noticed in some of the stories that I've read, when these people find themselves in these horrible situations in a crazy environment, how they almost turn inward and go, I can survive this because I am now this animal.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen wolf a lot. I've seen bear. I've seen, like, some sort of amphibian. Like, they're just like, you become that animal as a way to, it's almost like
a brain
switching it into, like, you know what to look for. This is, you're in here. Your senses are almost on overload.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, you are trying
to... because you need to. Yes. Yeah, you need the senses to be on overload, I reckon.
And I wonder if everybody has that ability or if it is literally just something that gets triggered in your brain in order to make you process how your body is... all of these new hormones and messages from your brain... it's a way for your consciousness to understand what is happening to your body. It's kind of like, you're safe, you are a wolf.
Yeah.
You know what to do.
I wonder if that, like, I mean, it's been a bit of a pattern. It's kind of like, you wonder if your ordinary basic bitch could, like,
could swap
have
into
that
survival
instinct
mode
as well. or whether we're too conditioned into this, like, cushy lifestyle.
Potentially.
That we just, like, wouldn't even know.
Also, I love that you went, you know, the average basic bitch. Like, not your Joe Bob next door. It's like, no, your average, I wonder if your average basic bitch has this survival. I mean, I think quite possibly it could live within us all.
That's why I think, like, because your average Joe, like, probably, maybe, but your average basic bitch, like a millennial or a Gen Z, like, whoa. Put them in an environment where...
Like, don't kidnap any Gen Zers and chuck them in a strange environment.
But I'd watch that show.
Oh, my God. yeah. I just think that's interesting that this pattern in these stories is starting to arrive, which is people embodying animals of the environment in order to...
It's actually pretty interesting.
...navigate their way through it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's something in that.
Surely. I wonder if it'll kind of keep becoming this, like, theme throughout our stories.
It's interesting as well that this guy, Baby Norman, it seems like, I mean, obviously, I haven't read the memoir, what he did with his life post the accident, did he continue his extreme sports, or did he kind of give it a rest?
I think he still surfs a lot. I don't think it's like as extreme, but he still does the activities that he had been taught with his father, and he does it with his son.
Yeah, you just gotta wonder what kind of personality this guy has.
He seems pretty centered, pretty chill. I watched a few like interviews. Apparently, to like write his memoir, he had to visit the site a few times, and obviously, like, that was a whole process for him. But yeah, because he was so young, he didn't really understand what he kind of went through, and then he had to, like, process all that when he wrote the book, like, when he was 40 or something.
Losing a family member in a horrible accident is, like, so scary for me. Yeah,
couldn't.
It's, yeah, it would take so much mental strength to leave them to try and save yourself.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
But then, Norman was, again, like, conditioned to be like, all right, like, I need to survive. Like, this is the situation I'm in. I've tried to wake my dad up, but he's not waking up.
Yeah, like, I have to
save myself. I waited for 7 hours here. Like, I'm going to die. This is what I need to do.
Yeah, because
I am a wolf.
I am a wolf now.
Yeah.
Because it's different from my story with the two men when they were both alive, but they're in this predicament of like, okay, well, you know, do I cut the rope or do I not cut the rope? Yeah. And we talked about how if it was a family member, could you do it?
Yeah.
And I think we both agreed, absolutely.
Yeah.
But if your family member is already dead, it's...
You wouldn't want to leave him there.
Yeah. That's so, oh my gosh, that poor wee man.
Yeah.
Baby Norman.
Baby Norm. But he's very grateful for his father.
Of course.
And he's like, just, he's taken bits and bobs that have made a real difference, obviously, with this survival story and like put that on to teaching his son, which I think is quite cool. Just like a generational thing.
Yeah, and everybody, you know, does that with their kids, with their own parents. You know, you're gonna take the bits and bobs that sat with you forever, and you don't translate everything.
No. Not even. Thank God.
hang on. yeah, well, thank you so much, Melissa, for sharing your story.
Yeah.
It was a goodie.
great chats. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
Yeah, we'll catch y'all.
Catch y'all later on the flip
my
side.
Story next week.
I'm pretty excited.
So excited. What about you, Missy? I mean, Ziggy? Where's Missy?
Oh, God, she's gone. She's probably gone eating something.
Oh, no, she's gotten into the food. All right, we better go.
Oh, okay, bye.
Bye.
5-4 Guide.
Hey guys, it's Olivia here. Thank you so much for tuning into the Survival Guide podcast. Melissa and I are brand new to this and we really appreciate your support. We can't wait to bring you some more crazy survival stories, so don't forget to subscribe and tune in next week. You can also find us on Instagram at the Survival Guide podcast. Once again, thank you, love you, kakite, goodbye.